This is Cy Freed, Voice of America, New York. G. Keith Funston is president of the New York Stock Exchange. He recently toured East European countries with a group of top-level U.S. business executives and industrialists. Mr. Funston, first of all, what would you say was the purpose of the trip?
Well, this trip was a tour, a news tour arranged by Time Life magazine, and the purpose was to get a group of top American businessmen to act as amateur journalists in visiting the five countries of Eastern Europe.
Which countries did you visit?
Well, we went to Hungary first, then Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, and ended up in Yugoslavia. We spent about 2 days and two nights in each city.
And what did you do in each city, for example?
Well, the pattern was pretty much the same. We had a chartered plane. We would arrive and be waited on by a delegation, and then we would be taken to a reception or luncheon. Then we would meet with the top governmental people and usually the top economic people. They would, the Chamber of Commerce or the trade group would give us a reception or a lunch or a dinner. Then we, in turn, would give reception and lunches for dinner for them, and usually also for a group of representative citizens. Then we would go on to the next place. In other words, we were in each place a short period of time, but we were working very hard all during that period of time, and while in 2 days, obviously, you can't probe in depth into a country, at least by spending 2 days in each of five, you get a pretty good idea of the comparative situation in each of the five. So I think we learned a whale of a lot more by going to five countries for 2 days each than we would have by of spending 10 days in any one country.
Do you recall any of the officials with whom you talked?
Yes, the most interesting, of course, of all from our standpoint was Marshal Tito in Yugoslavia. The next most interesting was the Prime Minister of Poland, Josef, his last name defies my pronunciation,
Sienkiewicz?
Sienkiewicz, that's it. And then we met with a very interesting economic people, a professor Sik in Hungary. In each country we met with very distinguished, very interesting people. Some of the most interesting contacts we had were those that were informal, people that we would meet at receptions and talk with them. For example, one night we had dinner in Budapest, and I sat between the leading historical novelist from Hungary, a man who's written 21 historical novels, and the professor of economics, who is the author of the New Economics in Hungary, which is attempting to put the profit motive back into the business structure. And the third man at the table was the leading sculptor of Hungary, who has some 70 pieces of sculpture in the museums and in the parks and so on in his country, and a great many in England and the United States, who was on his way to paint a picture of some of the royal family in England.
Mr. Funston, do you see any evidence of improvement in East-West relations, particularly in the fields of trade, business, and culture?
Well, I don't know. It's pretty hard to say. And of course, it depends entirely about with the country. In other words, you can't group all five of them in one group. I think that by and large, what these countries are they're interested, of course, in what they can get from the United States that will help them. They keep talking a lot about trade, wanting more trade, but the fact is that they don't have too much to produce that we in this country could find useful. And on their part, they're not talking really about buying our goods. What they want is they want the know-how and the machines and the equipment to set up manufacturing enterprises on long-term credits, which will enable them to make the same kind of goods that that we're making. So in other words, when they talk trade to us, what they really are talking about is our buying a lot of goods from them, and they're buying know-how and machinery from us, which would be a one-time deal rather than a continuing importation of products from the United States.
Well, could you appraise then the possibilities of future cooperation between us?
Well, of course, they were thinking mainly in terms of the business people, in terms of trade between us. I can see really very little, as between their countries and ours, very little prospects for any large amount of export and import business in the normal trade sense. I just don't think they have too many things that we in quantity want in our country that we don't already have at a better price and a better quality here. And their problem, of course, is getting the dollars with which to buy from us. And unless we're willing to give them long-term credits or credits beyond the normal commercial terms, which I certainly do not think we ought to do, I think there really is very little in the near-term future opportunity for us to do sizable import-export business with them.
Did you get any impressions on cultural exchange or artistic exchange, for example?
Yes, I think, except in most of many of these countries, they just limit the... they aren't for cultural exchange. In other words, they make it very difficult. Again, it depends on the country. I think Yugoslavia is free. Romania and Hungary are very tight. They don't want their people to go out to see the rest of the world. I think they're afraid that they may decide to stay there. I think they're afraid that they might be infected with the virus of capitalism, and they might see what the world is really like. So that I don't think they encourage their... I know they don't encourage their people to go out. And I don't think they encourage others too much to come in. Now, Yugoslavia is a different thing. The people there can travel freely, and foreigners are welcome and are visiting there in very large numbers.
But you saw no evidence then of an adaption, or an adaptation, I should say, of something like the capitalist system in production or anything?
Oh, yes, we did. We saw a great deal of evidence of it in all countries. And again, it varies from the country that has gone the furthest is Yugoslavia. And then I would say next Poland, and then next Czechoslovakia, and then next Hungary, and the least Romania. And in essence, what they found is that the communist system hasn't worked, and indeed it hasn't worked in bringing, to the extent that it should, in bringing a backward agricultural country up, and an industrialized, forward-looking country, prosperous country like Czechoslovakia, has just run right into the ground. And so what they're doing in each country, I think with the possible exception of Romania, but Hungary is starting a new program for the first time. Czechoslovakia is doing it. Poland is partway along. Yugoslavia is very well along putting in effect the profit system back into manufacturing plants, and also putting in effect what is a tax on the profits, or on the production anyway, of a plant, and having the government get that production getting that tax back. In other words, in essence, this is sort of what's been happening. The communist government, they own everything. They take all the money in. So they take it all in, and it's been central planning. Well, central planning has just gotten all messed up. And so they might say to a company that makes machine tools, they all love machine tools, each one of these countries, they may say, well, all right, we're going to give you enough of this common money. We're going to let you double your, give you the money to expand your machine tool plant, and we'll let you double it. So they go ahead and double it, and then they find that they can't sell the machine tools. Their costs are too high, or something is out of line. Whereupon, what the central planning should have done was have let them expand a food plant so that the people can can sell all the food they can get, and they should have gotten them to expand the food plan. But they didn't do it. So the people are hungry on the one hand, and they can't eat the machine tools. So what they've done is now they say to the machine tool man, look, we're going to set up a cost basis for you, and we're going to find out if you're profitable or not. If you aren't profitable, we're not only going to give you more money to expand an unprofitable operation further, but we're going to even think about closing your plant down. And then they say, and we're going to use our money that we get for other places in the economy that are profitable, where we do have needs. And there are countries, again, in varying ways, are even talking about putting some kind of an incentive in the plant, so that if the plant is profitable and expanding, the workers will get a little extra. Now, the only way they're taking fumbling steps towards capitalism in production, in their plans, but they're making very little steps towards giving incentives to the individual as individuals. For example, everybody can have a savings account, and they have, interestingly enough, in most all countries, they vary the interest rate as we do in our country, depending on how long the people are willing to leave their money in there. In some countries, they will let them own a house, in some they won't. In some countries, they'll let a person own a townhouse and a country house if they're wealthy enough. In some countries, they will even let them own land. For example, a person in Poland, land was not nationalized there. It was not nationalized in Hungary. It's completely nationalized in Romania. So that they're a long, to answer your question about, they are taking definite steps towards capitalism, but they're feeble, small steps, and all you have to do is be in these countries and realize what a terrible thing it is that they should have gone back to feudalism so far, which communism really is, and that they're having to take these tottering steps towards capitalism so painfully that it's a pity they ever had to give them up, because they're now just learning the element, rudimentary steps of capitalism now that our ancestors learned 150 years ago.
Mr. Funston, what can be done, do you feel, on the part of the United States, both in government and in the private sector, to promote the kind of relations that would be mutually beneficial?
Well, I think one thing would be anything that we could do to get the truth across about Vietnam, for example. I was amazed at the strength of the feeling that at least the leaders with whom we talk, who by and large were parroting the Moscow line, how strongly they felt about Vietnam. We didn't get the impression, however, that the people really cared one way or another, except they weren't about to get involved. They didn't want to get involved in another war, and they feel that as long as Vietnam is a festering sore, that it may bring them in somehow or other. But it's just unbelievable how little they know about the truth about Vietnam. For example, they said it was terrible that you should send your bombers in and kill the poor North Vietnamese civilian population. When we said, well, don't you know that we don't bomb any place unless we warn the people out beforehand, they say, oh, that's just your propaganda. And then we said, well, how do you account then for preying on the population the way the Viet Cong will come into South Vietnam and will just take all the people of a city out and hold them hostages, or will come in and kill all the leaders? And any time a person is elected to political office, his life is in danger. And they say, well, that isn't true. That's propaganda. They just don't know. So that the more that we can do to get across our story on the political level, the better off we'll be. Then, of course, the best thing would be to, if we could encourage their people to visit our country and see what it's really like over here, that's one of the best advertisements that we could have. Also, I think that it's beneficial for groups like ours to go there and meet with the people, and we found that meeting with the business people, that they look like us, they dress like us, and in many ways they think like us. The differences aren't quite as great when you're on a person-to-person basis as the governments want it to be. And most of these governments appear like to give the impression that they're pretty free of Moscow influence internally with respect to domestic economic policy. I think you have to accept that with a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek, but they are independent. They're growing. They're getting more and more independent. But nevertheless, Hungary and Poland have Russian soldiers stationed in there. Romania, and well, all of them, most of them, have a common border with Russia. So the Russian presence is a very large and threatening one. And I think they pretty much all sing the communist line domestically and internationally. And I don't think, in other words, they could go too far in any direction if Russia didn't want them to. It's also interesting that the countries that are allegedly the furthest advanced in bespeaking independence of Russia from an international standpoint, namely Romania, is also the country where the people in it have the least individual freedom.
Mr. Funston, may we have some general impressions that you carried back with you from this tour?
Well, one of the thing that I had was the way that communism in the eastern satellite countries is not a common party line in terms of its application to the country. In each of the five, it was different. For example, in some countries, communism meant complete collectivization and nationalization of all farms. In others, it didn't. In some countries, an individual was not entitled to own any land or to have any kind of ownership of a little store. In others, it was possible, and each of these countries is developing internally its own interpretation of communism. They are all moving towards an accommodation of their defunct systems to the profit system, or really to capitalism. And this varies with the country. Romania is the furthest away from it and really shows the less inclination to move towards it, that is in terms of action. Yugoslavia is the furthest down the road. However, their steps are all really quite faltering. But their communism is intensely related to nationalism. And so that international communism, in terms of having one pattern for the whole world, seems to be being fragmented by nationalistic communism. And one thing that was of interest was the intense nationalistic feeling that was reflected in many of these countries by the way that they treasure their old things. For example, Warsaw, which was 86% leveled by the Germans as a part of a planned destruction, the first buildings that were restored there were the palaces. And the old market square, which was completely leveled, was rebuilt with the outer facades being in exactly the same style as it had been when the square was built in the early 18th century. Well, now we in the United States wouldn't do this at all. We wouldn't. If we were rebuilding something, we probably would rebuild something in modern materials in the least expensive way. But we would do this, and we would use some of the money we save from doing that to provide housing for the people, which these countries don't do. I mean, the housing situation is just horrible in all of them. We found, for example, that the populations were actually declining. I think in Romania, the figure I remember, I think it was the city of Bucharest, 600,000 people die a year and 200,000 are being born. I guess this is in all of Romania. They have abortion legalized in many of these countries. And they are now, in Romania, they were just changing the law so that abortion could no longer be legalized because of the effect it was having on the population. And another thing that was so interesting was the way that nearly all the women worked in these countries. They have to work. And yet, on the one hand, the economic setup is such that the women have to work. On the other hand, because they're working, they can't look after children. They legalize abortion. then this means the population is declining. So then they turn around and say that we're not going to legalize abortion anymore. So presumably the population will go up, and then this will mean that the women can't work. So this central planned economy is just in a mess everywhere.
But you do feel that the visit itself, the tour itself, was worthwhile.
The tour was very, very much worthwhile. And in other words, I think it opened our eyes to the realization that you have to look, and our government and has to look at our relations with each of these countries on its own basis, dependent upon the relationship of the country as a whole, the situation in the country. I think from our standpoint that our exposure to these businessmen, many of whom had never talked to Americans before, I think that they realized that as people we were very similar to them. And I also think we were very much impressed with the diplomatic in most countries and most people we met. I think our diplomats are favoring us, are representing us very well, although probably another impression we had was that it would probably be a good idea if they had more opportunities for all the ambassadors in these countries to get together and to talk about their common problems, and probably would be a good idea if some of the policymakers in Washington went out there a little bit more often to keep the staff out there in touch with the policy and have them reflect their views back to Washington as what they think ought to be done.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Funston.
Right.
We've been talking with Mr. G. Keith Funston, president of the New York Stock Exchange, who, together with a group of U.S. businessmen and industrialists, toured Eastern Europe recently. This is Cy Freed, Voice of America, New York.
Nice.